Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the New Books Network. My name is Lee Pierce. I am an assistant professor at SUNY Geneseo in Rhetoric and Communication. And today I am so excited to be joined by not only an incredibly intelligent colleague, a talented writer, but also a friend, Dr. Michael Mario Albrecht, who is currently an assistant professor of communication at Eckerd College, but soon to be transitioning to an independent scholar, maybe something that we'll talk a little bit more about today. But the more immediate issue is Dr. Albrecht's wonderful book, Masculinity in Contemporary Quality Television, published by Routledge in 2015. This book explores everything from the mangina scene in Californication, to bromances in the league, to the Obama crisis of masculinity, post-bailout masculine crisis, and hipster masculinity, the schlemiel, and a variety of television shows that you're sure to recognize from the 08 to 2012 period, including Girls, Louie, Hung, Breaking Bad, and Mad Men. And I'm excited to have Dr. Eckerd here. I think this is just a wonderful book. It really shows the complexity of this thing that we call hegemonic masculinity. And for anyone who's been even remotely keeping up with the news lately, there's been this big thing about the Gillette razor ads and taking on contemporary masculinity and how it fights back against hegemonic masculinity. And that discourse is really interesting because it does talk about the hegemonic or the most frequent, the dominant form of masculinity as being this one-size-fits-all thing. And then, of course, looking at these other types of masculinities as its competitors. And what this book really demonstrates through a really close analysis of all these television shows is, A, not only that contemporary quality television is still a site fruitful for analysis, but also that masculinity is really this very complicated, ambiguous, ambivalent set of tropes and rhetorical performances and anxieties that, while none of these particular characters, as Dr. Albrecht says in the book, are good models for what we might call an alternative masculinity sort of moving forward that's like, you know, less rapey and less violent, they do sort of point to the way in which masculinity sort of always is its own downfall. And that provides fruitful ground for rhetorical scholars, critical scholars, and post-feminist studies, or feminist studies, depending on where you fall on that time spectrum. So again, I'm very excited to interview this wonderful book. And Mike, are you there? Great. Okay. And we're going to call you Mike. You said that was okay. And do you use his pronouns?
He's pronouns, and Mike is great.
Great. And I use she pronouns, although the listeners know that, but I'll let you know too. All right. Well, gosh, this is a great book. And I just wanted to start with, you know, let's start with the obvious question that I think everyone's going to have. So the last chapter of this book takes up Louis C.K.'s performance of masculinity in the show Louis. And obviously, the last couple years have sort of shown Louis C.K.'s hand in terms of masculinity and misogyny. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you see that, what you think that chapter was doing, and how you see it in relation to what's happened in history since?
Yeah. So I always thought Louis was doing a really interesting thing with masculinity that I thought he, there's an episode that I specifically look at in the book where he it's about a rape scene. So it's sort of like a reverse rape scene where he acts as if he is being raped, where the person he's on a date in pushes his head into her crotch as if he is and he doesn't want to. And so he is sort of the ways in which sort of that is sort of seen as the norm in the dating scene. And so what was always fascinating to me was sort of Louis had this very sharp awareness of the role of sort of power and the role men had. And so I always thought like, oh, here's a guy who gets it. I guess in the last year or two, we kind of learned that, oh, he was a guy who didn't get it, or maybe he got it and didn't give a shit. I don't know. So that's what I had mentioned to you earlier, that I didn't think that chapter had aged well, because I sort of looked at him as like, oh, here's a model of like a guy who's really like working through these things and really thinking very deeply about like what it is to be a man in the 21st century. Because I think that we are at this point that if you want to be a woke, for lack of a better word, man in the 21st century, it's not just a matter of like saying like, oh, I want to be less rapey, to use your term, but like you have to really, really put in a lot of work and think about it and think about your like what it means, and think about like, oh, so when you're dating, going on a date with someone, like what, how do you talk about sex? How do you think about these, the little things that might be moments of control? And I thought he sort of got it. I don't know. And so like, I was very disappointed when I'm like, oh, like either, I don't know which is worse, that he didn't get it or that he did get it and didn't care. I don't know. But you said you thought that maybe you might not agree with that.
Yeah, I don't think you're giving your reading of Louis enough credit. I know, granted, I don't want to give Louis C.K. any credit, but I think so. First, I'm going to read from page 92 where you sort of lay out the thesis of the Louis chapter, because I think the language is important here. Also, you use the word rapacious in the book instead of rapey, so maybe I'll use that so I sound more distinguished. All right. So you say on page 92 that Louis creates a tension between multiple versions of masculinity. However, it refuses to endorse one as dominant or preferable. As such, the series queers traditional masculinity and heterosexual romance by demonstrating the futility and the absurdity of the binary structures upon which the logic of those discourses rests. And so your reading of that scene is really important, because it kind of demonstrates the way in which the show and him as like both himself, but also the actor of the show, take up these kind of Larry David like positions, but with respect to masculinity more than say like social niceties. And then you say that despite his best efforts, despite Louis C.K.'s best efforts to queer hegemonic masculinity, Louis cannot ultimately escape the weight of traditional gender norms in his struggle to displace them. So for me, what I found compelling about this is that the whole entire book is set in the context of the Obama administration, right? So roughly 2008 to 2014, and you've got a couple things happening there. One, you have this really interesting I think you call him a fet, right? Obama's kind of non-traditional masculine performances, and how that's kind of both energized but also brought into crisis new modes of masculine being in America. And then also the economic crisis that happens in 08. And a lot of these shows are almost, I think Hung especially and Breaking Bad are both kind of in direct response to the way that when you can't be a breadwinner for your family anymore, you kind of fail to be a man. So What makes sense to me is that if your reading of Louis as kind of the best attempt to queer masculinity, even though obviously not a perfect attempt, comes out of the emergence of this particular historical time period, it would make sense that when you get a new era of masculine performance, i.e. the Trump administration, that what was once a queering of masculinity and sort of a refusal to accept the binary structure and kind of its awkward slippage, you would get kind of the reassertion of masculine dominance. And so I think it actually has proven you right that he turned out to fail, because the show was in a particular historical context, and now you would need to read his performance from a different historical vantage.
That's a generous reading of me. Thanks. I would like to give one little shout out though to that term queer heterosexuality. The term comes from Annette, I'm going to get her name wrong, Schlitzer, my German's terrible, and television studies scholars, Leslie Haywood and Mary Lisa Johnson. They did a great reading. I don't know if you ever saw 6 Feet Under, It's
actually just started it after I read this book. It's very interesting.
Oh my God. And that character of Nate was sort of like a great performance of that guy who really wants to get it and never quite does. And like, maybe it isn't, maybe you're ultimately not able to get it. Like, you know, and me who's trying, always trying to be that, and maybe it all ultimately it is because, the patriarchy is so all encompassing. Like maybe no one ever can. Like the point is always like, you have to keep trying. It's Sisyphusian.
Well, yeah. And one argument you can make about Louis C.K. is that he did try.
Yeah.
And, or at least he performed. And that's where it gets tricky. It's like, is he the performance or is he him? But
yeah.
He did try. And maybe just the way in which we just have no outside of certain masculine paradoxes, maybe that's what ultimately led to kind of him just not adopting. I don't know. I mean, we'll never, that's the thing with rhetoric, but it's a really interesting question. And again, I don't think it damns the chapter. I think it just makes the chapter like historically constrained. And now you have a different set of constraints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting to see like what happens, like if masculinity was, we did have this sort of moment of masculinity in crisis. And as I pointed out, like masculinity has been in crisis, like every 20 years or so, there's always that discourse. Then sort of the reaction is like, all right, let's see if we can get the most boorish guy next to be president and like, just see how terrible we can get. And like, yep, we have President Pussy Grabber now.
I know. Oh God. Although it does raise an interesting question. We're going to go way far afield, but then we'll come back to the book. But you know, this thing with Aziz Ansari and the Me Too movement, have you heard of? Okay. So I read a bunch of case studies following that. And you know, that's a situation where he invited a woman over. She came over. They were awkwardly kind of not making out, but like hanging out in the living room. She kind of didn't really want to be there. She was like moving away from him. He would move closer. He was kind of being a little bit kissy and trying to sort of make it happen. And she was not feeling it. She didn't speak up. He didn't recognize what was happening. And then eventually she kind of was like, I just want to go home. And he calls her a cab. And I always thought it was interesting that we lump that into hegemonic toxic masculinity, right, and Me Too, because the other reading of that is that he's occupying kind of this liminal space between hegemonic masculinity that's toxic and rapacious and everything, and this something other, which is this desire to not do those things, right? Which is to say, like, to wait for consent and to make sure she's comfortable. And I always thought it was weird that we immediately binarized, just like with Louis C.K. I mean, he definitely binarized himself recently by just kind of going all in for it. But I think part of it is, too, is as a culture, we're very reluctant to recognize those ambiguous moments. And so I think it's also brave of you to, in this book, you really try. I mean, you really try to give these guys a generous read, not because of who they are or because you want to rescue some kind of masculine origin, but because you're really trying to see where there's potential for change in some of their behaviors. I mean, even Adam from Girls, who I just found so loathsome, and I couldn't watch the show for a bunch of reasons, but I went back and I rewatched it while I was reading this book. And I just was like, you know, you're right. The eyes that you have for this particular show are so insightful and are drawing ideas. And of course, you just came out with a piece that I'm excited to read on this particular same case study with Adam and the hipster masculinity. So just because Louis C.K. just wound up being kind of the jerk all along, I don't think it undermines the quality of the project, which is to try to find alternative masculinities, if that's even the word that we want anymore, from these texts that come out of this very unique historical time period.
Well, Adam was sort of the opposite, where I kept reading all of these think pieces where people kept asking the question of, like, what should we think of Adam? And I had the same thing as you. I was like, well, this guy's an asshole.
Yeah, your contextual analysis, by the way, is phenomenal. You must have done a ton of research on what people were writing about these shows in the blogosphere.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of like, that's just sort of what I do, though. Like, that's how I spend my mornings, is I read think pieces.
Yeah. Well, it shows. I mean, it definitely paid off in the book.
Well, thanks. But like, yeah, I just kept thinking of like, well, why there? And I think in my head, it's like, I think it's because Adam's hot.
Is he though? Like, I do not think that guy's hot. When they casted him for Kylo Ren in, I was like, really, this guy? But that character is that similar kind of Anakin Skywalker, I'm a giant baby, but I'm trying to assert. So it kind of made sense in that way, but I just did not. He's not hot like Hayden Christensen was hot.
No. I mean, again, like, and it, maybe I didn't even think he was hot, but like people do think he's hot.
Yeah, I don't get that. I think that's I think that's character transfer. That's like people who thought Chris Farley was hot. I think that's just character transferring. But anyway, let's assume people did think he was hot, because I do agree with that.
People kept wanting, kept thinking like, well, Hannity keeps needing to give this guy a chance. I'm like in that one scene where he definitely raped the woman. People saying like, was it a rape? And I'm like, well, it definitely was a rape. Like that was wasn't even kind of a binary, but yet people. So, but why are people talking about this? And I think there is this thing where, like, if we start calling things rape, then a whole lot of people have to like go back into their past and either have to say like, oh, something I did was I was a rapist, or something that happened to me was a rape, and that's really hard on either end of it. To like go back to and like reevaluate your past.
Yeah, I mean, it's also one of the problems of a surface depth binary, right? That once characters have depth, when they do something crappy, it suddenly becomes very. I mean, that's kind of what's interesting about all these characters. You know, Walt White from Breaking Bad, and Don Draper from Mad Men, and Adam from Girls, is that they are, from a surface perspective, really like problematic. But then from a depth perspective, you can suddenly make a lot of exceptions and apologies and, oh, well, maybe they did it for this reason. And, oh, maybe they didn't. So that's the other problem, is that we assume that because a character has depth, or because a public figure has depth, that somehow apologizes, that's an apology for them doing what they did. Because we have another binary we have trouble working across, I think, is that surface depth binary.
Yeah, I think you're right. And depth and context are something that, like, as a culture, we have a really hard time with. I think in some ways, like with rape, at least when I talk to my students about it, my students like to say, well, there's a lot of gray area. And I think it's easier for me when I'm teaching them to say like, sure, what if we just call the gray area, let's not do that. Let's call that red. Stop.
It's just part of the black area.
Yes. Then that makes it easier for you to have to deal with that. But I don't know if I really believe that deep down. That's just like my way of training them not to rape. Right.
Have you seen Amy Schumer's Clear Eyes, Full Hearts, Don't Rape skit?
Yes.
That to me, it's
funny,
man. When she's on, she's on. But yeah, but right. But the because the paradox is the way that we say, do not do this very specific action that looks like this, this, and this. But then the whole culture, and I think these texts are really good examples, are either giving people this masculinity anxiety or crisis, or these pressures to act in this certain way, like football, and this kind of machismo, take what's yours, it's yours for the taking kind of thing. And I was watching Remember the Titans the other night, and I remember thinking, you know, this is a very racially woke movie. I mean, it's trying to do a lot of things for the advancement of interracial relationships, and the race binary gets very displaced. But what you see is this incredibly strangely like Disney version of homophobia show up, combined with this incredibly like passé attitude toward excessive violence. And I remember thinking like, see, this is the problem. We've taught that real men integrate, but we've also taught that real men are still violent, homophobic, like militant kind of assholes. Oh, shoot. I don't know if I can swear on this podcast. I've never tried. So let's not do that.
I've already sworn a couple times, I think.
Have you? Well, I mean, I don't know. To be honest, we're going to quote like Don Draper and Girls. So it's like, how are you going to avoid it? But we'll see. So good. Way to test the boundaries. So, I mean, yeah, it just points to all these paradoxes. And so then when students say there's a gray area, on the one hand, it's like, no, there's no gray area of behavior. If you don't have ongoing consent and it's pretty clear that someone is just not comfortable being there, or even if you're just have a little bit of an inkling, you back off. I think the gray area for them comes in the fact that like we have all these mixed messages from society. So for me, it's about tearing apart which gray area are you talking about? Because the one we can talk about, the other one is just you making an excuse for why you don't have to do things you don't want to do.
And you know, as someone who like me is not, doesn't like binaries in general. Right. Consent is one of those things where like, all right, like I'm going to take off my post-structuralist hat and say like, no, this is a binary. Consent is mandatory. And like, I know what consent looks like. Even though deep down, I know that it's a construct.
Well, and even if, even if I mean, this is Derrida, right? We're getting deep here. But even if consent is not a binary, I'm going to act as if it's a binary because that's the right political move. Is that kind of what you say? What you're saying? Yeah.
And I don't teach my students, even though usually my move with my students is always to complexify. I don't know if complexify is a word. Complicate is a word.
Let's run with it.
Right. But in this particular moment, it's not. It's like, no, this one I'm going to simplify.
Yeah. So I think that's what's interesting is that the more we presume that because we give depth and complexity, and I think about this a lot, like sometimes I'll see a meme or something on the internet that like Donald Trump was someone's baby once too or something.
Ugh.
And I get what they're trying to do there. They're trying to say, like, you need to have sympathy and humility for this person because they're a human like everyone else and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm fine with that. It does not make my brain uncomfortable to say that I don't agree with policies and behaviors and then also say that he probably has a very deep character and has a lot of stuff going on. I think the problem is that we assume that one of these has to rule the day.
Yeah.
But it's perfectly capable for me, for example, for me to think of Louis C.K. as someone who is complex and occupies all of these strange liminal positions with respect to masculinity and had this show where he really tried to push back and gives to charity and la, 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 right? All day long. But also he did a bad thing. And I don't need one of those to be true in order for my brain to process that.
Yes.
But I think we act in pop culture a lot as if you got to choose one direction or the other. And I think that was the problem with Adam is that it was hard to like him as a character and then also say that that was a rape scene. But I think both of those things are true. He's a likable character. That was rape. I don't have to dislike you to put you in jail for doing something illegal.
Mm. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great reading. I thought there was so much to think about with this book. And I'll tell the listener, we are just going to scratch the surface of this book. It is absolutely worth a one-on-one read. And I'm excited to announce that the Kindle version and the paperback version both just dropped down to around $30. So they are a really great price now from Amazon. And as always, you can get a copy for your library so that students and other faculty and members of the staff can read the book. Or you can request a copy from your popular local library so that members of your community can read the book. If you'd rather do that than purchase a personal copy, that's a great way to give back. All right. So let's zoom out from this conversation about a number of things that started with Louis C.K. Why don't you tell a little bit about the historical context? Because even though we've touched on it, the chapter that you do on Obama's sort of effeminity and it combining with the bailout and how that drives your reading of a lot of these chapters is really important because obviously one of the things that's great about rhetorical criticism is that it's always historically bound. And I think you do a great job of doing a history of the present that's really hard to do. So I'd love for the readers or the listeners to learn more about that.
So I guess what got me thinking about this was, I guess there was two shows in particular that got me thinking about this. So they came out about the same time, and one was Breaking Bad and one was Hung. They both came out, but Breaking Bad starts in 2008. I think Hung might have started in 2009. But both of these were shows where someone has to start. They can't make ends meet in the regular economy, and instead they have to start. They have to make. So in Breaking Bad, he has to become a drug dealer, and in Hung, he becomes a prostitute. And both of these are right at the moment of the financial breakdown that happened in 2008. And so they're speaking to this sort of cultural anxiety we have about like, oh, nobody can get a job. And that hits especially hard to men, especially white baby boomer men who are like are supposed to be getting really close to being retired. And instead are having to like take up a new job. And that was a discourse that we heard all the time in the news was like, all right, these guys are getting laid off and they're in their 50s and they, you know, they have to start learning a new job. And like, they didn't know what to do and they felt anxiety and they felt.
Hey, wait, real quick. That would have been a great title for this book, Guys Getting Laid. And then in parentheses off.
Yes.
That would have been that would have been a great subtitle for the book.
That is pretty good.
All right, keep going.
I had lots of titles that were, that the editor didn't like. I wanted to call it 21st Century Schizoid Man as an homage to the.
Ooh, or the Schlemiel. Yeah,
there was a lot of good stuff in this book. This was the one the editor went with. Sometimes you don't get a choice. And in my first book, I didn't know that the writer actually has some power over the editor. But live and learn. But yeah, so like there was this, I was like, oh, well, this is really interesting. There's two shows that are about this. And the more I started to like see what was going on in television, I'm like, started to see a lot of this sort of anxiety about like, oh, the way that men used to be, and like, oh, Mad Men was going on at the same time. It actually started a little bit earlier. But like, oh, like people, like, why do people like have this reverence for Don Draper? Why do we like him? It's weird that we like him. Like, I actually did like him. I'm sort of like, what is it I like about him? He's a womanizer. He's a chauvinist. Maybe it's just because I want to drink and smoke. I get that part, I guess. But like, what is it about that time that like, what is it evoking? And like, I was sort of like saying like, oh, well, maybe it's evoking this time when there was a certainty about masculinity where men had the jobs and they had a place, their place in society was seen as solid. But in 2008, like there was no jobs. And that was also the moment when Obama gets, excuse me, Obama gets elected. And he was a president that was very much unlike a man's man. He wasn't George Bush, who was out on the ranch clearing brush, right? He was wearing tan suits and he was eating arugula, right? He was putting fancy mustard on his, wasn't it Dijon mustard? Some sort of mustard that wasn't regular mustard on his hot dog, right? He was, you know, he wore, he wasn't Ronald Reagan. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't going to be in any cowboy movies like Reagan was. He was this other sort of guy. He was Ivy League, but he was not the kind of Ivy League like George Bush was, who was like at frat parties. He was a constitutional law scholar, and his wife was fashionable, and like they were hanging out in Martha's Vineyard, and you know, and like this was a different version of masculinity. He didn't look like he was ever going to clear brush, and so like all of these things were sort of going on at the same time. And I can sort of, I was sort of reading that. I could see that going on in these sort of same, these texts, these televised texts that were going on. And so like the more I started to watch these television shows, and the more I started reading the reviews of them and sort of these paratexts, sort of like, you know, that's sort of how the book project came about. And I just, you know, started reading those things through. And then I started reading all this literature on masculinity. And it turns out that there's been all of these moments when this crisis has happened. So at the turn of the 20th century, people were all worried about men not. That's when the Boy Scouts started, because they thought everyone was going to be a mama's boy. And then in the 50s, people were worried about this because it was mama's boys again too. Then there's been all of these kinds of moments through history when masculinity sort of emerged as we need to be a man's man. And it showed its face in popular culture, and like this sort of perfect storm of the Wall Street collapse mixed with this new president who was not traditionally hegemonic masculinity, I think brought about this moment in culture. And I think we're still sort of seeing the implications of this because we still don't have full employment. Now we have this boorishly masculine guy. We're still seeing this Me Too movement going on. The Kavanaugh hearings, I'm sure that those sparked 1,000 dissertations that day on like his performance of masculinity. So I don't know. Masculinity is this fascinating thing. I actually just sent out a piece about the True Detective. Did you watch the first season of True Detective?
It was fabulous.
It is. This was actually a piece that got accepted for edited collection, but then the whole collection fell apart. So I just reworked it and sent it back out. But like, man, there's some weird masculinity stuff going on in that.
Yeah, especially like in relationship to the occult. Well, that's cool. I'll be excited to read that. I never finished the second season, but the first season was really good.
Yes, and the third season just ended, but I haven't had any brain capacity for any serious TV. Like I've been watching, I just watched 13 Reasons Why, which is not that serious.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's a really... So here's my problem with that show. I don't buy that the character that she needs to be to drive the plot of the show is the character... Like, I don't... So that girl who's organizing all of this, like the mastermind behind all of this shenanigans, I don't have a hard time imagining that she would commit suicide, because I think one of the points that I think the show could be making is that you kind of never know.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that she would stand back and just abide all of that trauma kind of quietly and then commit suicide because she's lonely and alienated doesn't vibe with the character that she is.
Yeah. It's also
and I don't know if that's because I'm being like mental health normative here, because I'm trying to think, like, could this just be a really fascinating case of we just never know who is having mental health issues? But I just don't know. Rhetorically, it just seems to have way too many gaps for me.
Oh yeah, there's lots of problems with that show. Not the least of which is like it's the show is about this woman, but the protagonist is a dude. Right. So
yeah, that's the other thing I have a problem with. And again, it's that depth surface thing.
It's a manic pixie dream girl. Right.
Right. Yeah. And that's weird because he's like rescuing her after her.
Yes.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
And it's got all the tropes. Like, so it has the magic Negro trope, right. But instead he's a magic Puerto Rican gay guy.
Yeah.
So it's just all tropes, why I watched it, just because it was not very, I didn't have to think real hard about it.
Have you watched Speechless with Minnie Driver about they have the son who is nonverbal and in a wheelchair?
No, that sounds pretty.
So it's very well done. And they have a magic Negro on that show as well. But they're sort of, it's weird because it's like hipster racism, right? Like, oh, we know we've only got one black guy, and he also happens to be this magical figure who makes sure that the white kid is happy. Mm-hmm. But they do a really good job between him and the main character in the wheelchair. I've really enjoyed it, but I kind of feel guilty too, because I didn't, with 13 Reasons Why, I just didn't like it. But I like this show, and I also know that it's very tropey, and I don't know. I'll be interested to see what you think of it. Okay, so let's go back to the book. I hope the listeners at home really love pop culture, because we're making a lot of references today, and I really hope they're
like, yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's so we got this masculinity crisis. It's driving all of these chapters. And I think the next place logically to go that we haven't talked a lot about is Mad Men. Because to me, in terms of just the overall obvious relationship to masculinity, less so the bailout, but certainly I think kind of in a way, because this was a time where just like money was there for the taking, and you've got this birth of like the original hipsters, right? These men with the suits on Wall Street. The Thomas Frank book, The Birth of Cool. I think that's, you read that, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I think that's in the book. And so just this idea that there's just like the world is out there for the taking, and ad execs, and this just like beautiful time where men were men and the sheep were afraid and all that stuff, as my father would say, who was also a terrible human being and in the crisis of masculinity my entire life. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the relationship you see between Mad Men and these two moments of the bailout issue and the masculinity crisis of 08.
Mad Men was actually the last show. I didn't watch it when it was coming on because I was in the throes of my dissertation writing. And it was actually the last show I watched. Like, I knew enough about, because it was so big in popular culture. Like, I knew what it was about. some mutual friends of ours, I don't know if I need to name drop them, but they actually had their engagement party or their wedding party was Mad Men themed.
Actually, let's get some shout outs. I'll give a shout out to Emily Winderman and Attila Halsby. Attila should be on the show soon for his new book. And then.
Oh, nice. Also, is it out?
No, but it's imminent. So I'm waiting.
Yeah, I knew it was coming out. I just didn't know if it.
And, you know, Paul Johnson, because I actually, the only one episode of Mad Men I ever watched, I watched at Paul Johnson's house.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I'll shout out. I don't mind. I'm not above it.
Okay, cool. But yeah, so I knew it was Mad Men was the show at the time. And like, so I knew it had to be a chapter and like, it was in my proposal and like, but it was literally the last thing I watched and I sort of binged it. So I was sort of fascinated. I didn't know I was going to like it as much as I did. Cause it was like one of those things like, oh, everybody likes this show. I'm not going to like it. Cause like, I'm not usually a period piece kind of guy.
You and I are the same person. The minute somebody likes something, I'm like, poo-poo. I will not be watching that.
But yeah, like period pieces aren't usually my thing. And I'm like, I don't care about like, you know, like wardrobes and like clothes aren't going to do it for me. But I really did quite like it. I thought it was going to, like, Don Draper is a very dark character. I like that. But yeah, I don't know if you can tie Mad Men quite as much into the financial crisis, in part because it starts earlier, but you definitely can tie it into sort of the idea of masculinity being in crisis and like, why is it that people would just asking the question of like, why would you want to like celebrate this? Why would you want to, in the same reason? So it also in those same years, that's when the Leo's version of The Great Gatsby came out. Like, why would you want to have a Great Gatsby party? The Don Draper's character and Jay Gatsby, I think, are very similar. I make that point in the book, and I'm by no means the only person that's made that. It's pretty obvious. Spoiler: they both make up their past, and they're living the American dream that way. But like, I don't think in either case, like, I don't think we're supposed to like them. We're supposed to look at them as like being these sort of devious people who like make up their pasts and can't find happiness. Like at the end of the day, like I think both Gatsby and Draper aren't happy in their lives. Like no matter how much they, on the surface, they're big parties and drinking and women. Like at the end of the day, they're pretty sad people. Like right? I don't know. But people still have the parties. Like, is it just the surface? Maybe this is the surface depth. Like on the surface, Don Draper's life looks good, right? He's got a wife at home making him food, and then he's got his side pieces all over that he's sleeping with, and then he's got, you know, booze, and he's got, you know, all the stuff. But like, you know, he's not happy. It's a show about his depression.
Well, I think, too, there's this way in which, and I think this is often common of historical periods, is that, and you make, I mean, I think you kind of get to this with the nostalgia in the, because the nostalgia is kind of your driving concept for this particular reading, but that there's this aesthetic of what we'll call, like, the height of, like, 1960s advertising culture that has just been so seared into the brains of people in a very flat surface way, like a very like sheer aesthetic, that even when the show comes out and tries to reinvest you in this other vision, this depth vision of what it must have been like at that time in these characters, in some ways, I think confirmation bias just has you picking up what matches the aesthetic in the first place. And that's why you wind up with like Mad Men engagement parties. Cause of course, if you were having a real Mad Men engagement party, everyone would be cheating on you and you would be doomed to a miserable marriage and you'd probably be marrying someone you don't want to marry in the first place. So I do agree with you. There's a very bizarre paradox of identification that I've always found very peculiar about people and their love of that show. I feel the same way about Game of Thrones.
Oh yeah. I don't watch that one.
I don't either. Too much rape. I can't. I'm out.
No, I don't like dragons and shit. Oh, and stuff. but like I just barely watched the Middle Earth one. But yeah, nostalgia is something like I have a book about nostalgia I keep wanting to write. But like I always like in my master's thesis is kind of about it because I always like, why do I feel nostalgic about the 60s? Like I wasn't there. But I feel it. Like when I see that moon landing, I'm like, yeah, moon landing. And I'm like, but I wasn't there.
Oh, see, I don't feel nostalgia for the 60s at all, but I totally feel nostalgia for the 80s, even though technically I grew up in them. I didn't really.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have got Kristen Hurl coming on to this show in a couple of weeks to talk about the bad 60s.
Oh, I love that. I wrote a review of that book for Southern Communication Journal.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and I think so that maybe we'll keep this, maybe I'll keep this question on the table for her to chat about that.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, her book is just fabulous. And your listeners should totally go and buy that book before they buy mine, because hers is way better than mine is.
You're terrible.
No.
Speaking of crisis of masculinity, you demand your book sales. Damn it.
Yeah, I demand my book sales. But that book is like it's been a long time since it's been an academic book that I just like enjoyed front to back, and like I don't know if you looked at my review, but like it's just glowing from start to finish.
I haven't, but I'll check it out before I interview her.
You should. Yeah, it's in Southern. But yes, like, yeah, the 60s is, I'll plug my next project. I'm working on a proposal right now for a book about, comparing 1968 and 2018. And like the 60s is just such this behemoth of a thing in our minds that like, we have to reckon with it. Like, even today, we're still having this fight about between the baby boomers and the millennials, that's still, you know, we still have three baby boomers running for president in 2020, at least. Who knows if Al Gore is going to throw his hat in the ring? I don't want to say that out loud, but yes.
I hope it's just a total, like a total carnival.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we
just
deserve.
Like, just people like would forget, like Mike Dukakis, come on in.
Yeah. Maybe Ross Perot will give it one last shot.
Yes. But yeah, like we're still like, so Mad Men is this moment, right before the 60s. So if the 60s are this moment when everything changed, right? That's the moment when masculinity got challenged, right? When men started growing their hair long and started questioning authority, and like everything happened. Like Mad Men is that moment before all that happened, everything went wrong, that's why I think people like looking at Don Draper, because by the end of the show, like, again, spoiler, it ends with him he's meditating, and he's embraced the 70s, and like some people must be like, man, that must suck. Like everything about Don Draper changes when he's meditating. Although a cynical read of the end is like, he's just faking it. He's just using that as another ad campaign. He's figured out that he can make money off of the new age movement of the 70s.
The one thing this show did really well was kind of leave you with this sense of where does he as an individual begin and the act of advertising end?
Mm.
And I don't remember. Did you mention the wheel, the really famous wheel scene in your book?
Yes, the nostalgia, like that's,
yeah.
That's from the first season where he sort of pitches nostalgia, and like so it's this very meta moment of the carousel. Where
yeah,
he talks
he's trying to sell the old school Kodak slideshows that you used to click the button and the wheel would turn and you'd put your slides in this giant carousel wheel.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so instead of talking about the machinery, he talks about like he's selling memories. Right. And so, but like the show is so self-reflective. It's like, yeah, that's what we're doing. We're selling this right to you. And like, yeah, they know. Matthew Weiner knows what he's doing. Weiner. I don't know if it's Weiner or Weiner.
Yeah. Well,
I loved his latest show, even though it got panned, The Romanovs.
I heard that was good, but it didn't make it.
I loved it. Huh. It was an anthology. And I love me some Russian stuff.
Oh, do you?
Yes. Good times.
This is like the most Russia has ever been mentioned on this podcast, I bet.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, sorry. It was German. It was German you mentioned earlier.
Oh, yeah. But there's a great nostalgia book by this Russian lord, because public memory in Russia and Germany both is really interesting. You know, I mean, just because they remember very differently there because their past is so weird. Not weird, but just like so differently constructed than ours.
That would be an interesting question. I'm sure someone's written this book, but sort of like, because obviously the way in which memory works has to be culturally constrained. So mm-hmm. We're talking a lot in this Mad Men chapter about how memory works and how Mad Men wants you to think that memory works. But I wonder, yeah, it'd be interesting to know how the similar types of actions are done in other countries, where I bet memory is kind of, the logic of memory is done very differently.
Yeah, there is a book, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but it's something nostalgia, like creating nostalgia, but it's done by this Russian woman. But yes, memory works very differently in Russia. But this is all of this memory that we're thinking is a very American thing, right? And Don Draper is the ultimate America, because America is where you can reimagine yourself, right? He is completely a person who reimagined himself through the war, through the Depression, through advertising. Like, he is, again, just like Jay Gatsby, like, he's the American dream. And like, masculinity has always been so tied up in the American dream. Think about Death of a Salesman, right? The American dream, masculinity. You got the two guys, one of them kills himself, the other one's Biff. I don't remember how it all goes, but it's something along those lines. It might not be Biff, but it's something like that.
The other ones.
That's the one who dies, is the one, right? It's the one who kills himself.
Oh my God. I've only ever seen the one with, it's the son. Is it Biff who plays the son? The dad is Dustin Hoffman.
Yes. Yes, in one
right?
version. Of
okay,
it.
Yeah. Right. And it's in one version. And then the son. Yeah, that's right. And right. But you got to imagine that Mad Men has to be paying homage to this phenomenon of sales, because at the same time that it's looking at the height of this, it's coming at it from the future, which knows that this all fell out from under everybody.
Oh, yeah.
So there's almost a way in which the fact that Mad Men came back right before the crisis hit for the bailout, and the economic downturn, it almost as if it were foreshadowing, because right around the time, like, if Mad Men had really started at the time that it really started, you would have hit the economic downturn in the advertising and sales market right around the same time. So it's almost like it's almost prescient, the way it kind of got us re-excited about the prospects of, like, new industry right before all that fell out from under us.
Yeah, so it's coming out. So does this start in 2005? I have to go back and look. But like, it's coming out right as Steve Jobs is trying to sell us on the new iPhones and stuff. So you can read it through that lens. Right, so they know that, like, the new iPods and the new iPhones are just the next sham, and that our lives aren't going to be any better. They're just going to be, you know, more
you're
capitalism.
Terrible. No, it actually premiered in 2007. So no, it was right on the cusp of that, because it was the end of 2007 when Bush signed the first. For the Fannie and Freddie, right before, because it was Obama who signed the actual auto bailout in. But no, I mean, I think July 19th too. No, you're right on the cusp. I mean, I think your reading of this as part of the bailout is spot
okay.
on. Absolutely. Yeah. 2007.
I love your generous reading of my book.
It's really good. I know you, and I know that you're not going to toot your own horn, so I'm going to toot it for you, because it deserves to be tooted. All right. So we are coming up at 45 minutes. This has gone really fast. This is a really fun interview. Do you want to say anything else about any of the other chapters in the book, or were there other favorite case studies that you, or other favorite characters that you studied that you sort of think are really good synecdoches for the book as a whole?
I will put just a little blurb in for, like, the League. And, like, I think it's sort of interestingly, I put that with.
Talked about the League yet.
Huh? Just because, like.
About the League yet.
I put it in for. Quality television is, like, people might not think of that as quality television. I might not think of it as quality television, but, like, it's such a interesting way in which they play with masculinity, and they play with this sort of trope of the hyper masculine, and they play with the idea of having a show that revolves around a fantasy sports league is so just sort of brilliant in the way in which they are able to use the sort of banter and the hyper masculinity that accompanies this. And it's got all of these great actors who I think have done lots and lots of things now that have been, so the Duplass brothers, I think, have done, like, I don't know, they've done 30 shows by now that have all been looking very introspectively at masculinity. And Nick Kroll has done so many different things. If you haven't watched Big Mouth, like, Big Mouth is a sex positive, pro feminist look at puberty in a way that, like, It's just mind blowing.
Is it? I just thought that show looked kind of creepy.
Oh, it
it's
is.
Good.
It's,
I'll take your word for it. I trust.
It is.
Okay.
And it's trying to be like, what if we looked at puberty from, again, a sex positive, pro feminist point of view? And I think Nick Kroll's a genius, and just all of the, and so this, the League is like, on the one hand, like, this show is like filthy and offensive, and you can just read it as potty humor, and I'm sure that there's a whole bunch of bros who just read it that way. But like, I really think it's doing something much more complicated than that. So that's sort of why I put it in there. And also because I was just like binging the show at the time, and I'm like, well, I'm binging it, might as well write about it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, some of the great works of our time. If you really think about it, I mean, what is Walden Pond but just binging on nature and writing?
Sure. Writing, I mean, why be in our field if you can't like write about the things you like, you know, or write about, you know, because the things that we like are very much a part of this sort of larger politics. And if you can't, if you're someone like me who's very invested in a larger political project and you can't find that in your everyday life, then, you know, you should find something else in your everyday life, because I don't know. That's sort of my two cents. That's my big takeaway. Do stuff you like, but like, make sure that like the stuff you like is sort of meaningful in like a larger political way. Like, don't,
sure,
you know, like my students are like, well, now I can't watch the show, and now I can't watch it without thinking about politics. I'm like, well, that's good, right? Like, you should be thinking about this. Oh, I did want to point one thing out. You started this on the new Gillette ad campaign. I'm convinced that the Gillette ads are the new Dove soap, in that I'm going to be reading so many student papers about it. I already had like three for my ideological analysis.
Yep, they all wanted to study it this semester. And I just, yeah. I wrote a list of arguments out. Last year it was Childish Gambino's This Is America.
Yes, it was. I said it to the person who does plagiarism, because I had five and I thought they were working together.
Oh, no, it was just, I mean.
They worked, but I was just like, I think they all are, because like they all had like a very similar kind of crappy analysis of Childish Gambino.
Yeah, and in 2016 it was Beyonce's Lemonade, and then it was the Childish Gambino in 2017, and then
But the Dove one still comes out. Like, I can see it when they raise their hand.
Oh.
When we talk about fat acceptance. Oh, that's who you should have on your show, by the way. As you know, Mish Zimdars.
No, who's that?
She does. She just wrote a great book about television and fat studies.
Ooh, okay. I will look that up. And well, you're ahead of me. Usually, to sign off, I say, hey, do you have any book recommendations? My hunch is you're going to have a lot, so I will add that to my list.
And I assume you have Caitlin's on your list, right?
Caitlin.
Bruce.
Yes, but I haven't heard back yet.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Hers just came in the mail yesterday. That's why I'm thinking of it.
Ooh, cool. Yeah. It's tough to get people to answer emails this time of year, which I'm not surprised by. I just think which I get. I mean, it's exhausting for me to read the books and then find time for the interview, too. So I can only imagine.
She just got back from England. So.
Yes, I know. I'm jealous of her life. Okay. There's a lot of people I might have to tag in this episode. We've done quite the inner circle. All right. So we're up at 51 minutes. And I think we have just, I mean, again, barely scratched the surface of the book. Luckily, scratched the surface of many other things that were not in the book. So I just once again want to encourage everyone who's listening, if you've enjoyed the conversation, or even if you didn't enjoy the conversation, but you think the book sounds like it might be cool, to check out Michael Mario Albrecht's Masculinity in Contemporary Quality Television, available from Routledge Press, published in 2015. And again, you can get it from the press itself, or also both the Kindle and the paperback versions are available new on Amazon for around $30, which is an excellent price range for a book like this. We're happy that the price dropped just in time for the interview. And if you're not interested in purchasing a book for yourself, we encourage you to reach out to your university or public libraries and request that they keep a copy of the book on hand. As you can tell, this is tapping into a lot of great popular culture, some really deep, important issues about masculinity and feminism, and basically how we're going to live the next 10, 20, 30 years of our lives if the way that we have been living it in terms of gender norms hasn't been working. And you really want to make that kind of information publicly available to the best of your ability. The New Books Network really appreciates presses like Routledge for working with us and making it possible for academics to get their work out there. And so I will also make a plug quick, because Mike, I heard that you're transitioning into an independent scholar role, also AKA an alt academic, and that you're going to be sort of starting your own little, like, I call them professorpreneurs.
Nice.
Yeah. So you're going to start your own little professorpreneurship. So do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about that? And I'd be happy to let the audience know what you're up to, because maybe you can be of help to them.
Yeah. So I'm starting an editing business. For a long time, I've worked as a freelance editor for working for somebody else. And so I'm starting now. I do line editing. I do developmental editing for academic books. I actually just did a YA novel. That's not really my wheelhouse, but it was fun. But yes, so I'm willing to work at any stage of the academic writing process. I've done dissertations, I've done books, I've done articles. So let me know, I can get into a conversation with you about what your needs are. My website is michaelmario.com. Was pretty excited that was available. Yes, and check me out. And there's a place there. We can start a conversation. Talk to me about editing. Yes, and I would like to thank Lee for having me on her program. It's been lots of fun.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on. It's been awesome. I have had just the best time with this. I mean, I originally got into the New Books Network because I essentially noticed that the channels in language and media and communications were almost entirely dead. So all of the content that they were getting was crossover from other channels, and there was no rhetoric. So I reached out to Marshall Poe, who is a history professor and also kind of an independent scholar and the CEO of New Books Network. He does it all nonprofit. It's all with a little bit of sponsorship through University Press, and he runs the whole shebang. And he was happy enough to bring me on board. And I will tell you, this has been just the best experience. And I hope that people are enjoying the podcast, and certainly feel free to send me feedback. My email is, you can find me at Lee Pierce at SUNY Geneseo if you just Google me, but my email is real easy. It's my last name, Pierce, like pierce your ear, my first initial L, at Geneseo, GENESEO.edu. All right. Well, Mike, it was awesome. I'm excited to hear more about your forays into all academia. And yes, if anyone's interested, check out michaelmario.com. A link will also be in the show notes, and pick yourself up a copy of Masculinity in Contemporary Quality Television, or as I've subtitled it, what did I say? Dudes Getting Laid, parentheses off, close parentheses.
Nice.
Which is how I'll be referring to it from now on. All right. Okay.
Great. Thanks again, Lee.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, bye-bye.